It's 6:27 p.m.
And welcome to the Pompey Politics Podcast.
Blue and yellow till we die. I'm Ian Tiny Morris.
And I'm Simon Sansbury. So there we go. That was... sorry, now we both decided to quickly go either grab refreshments or other things before we started. So we made it. We made it back to the microphones in time.
We did, just in the nick of time. Okay. Excellent. So how goes it, lizard brethren? Welcome to the... Welcome to the world of Gates.
Yes, so I went for my first jab yesterday. So I had my first vaccine. Fantastic experience. Military precision, queuing up in the car park in Kingston Crescent, and then literally kind of in the door and out again in between time, rolling up a sleeve and being jabbed in the arm. So yeah, absolutely brilliant. My thanks. It was almost a bit tearful for me. I kind of it was all that kind of like, I don't know, very kind of act of Britishness. Thank you so much. But yeah, it does. And thank you to everybody involved for making that a reality. It's a really good sign. A really, really good sign.
Yeah, incredible, isn't it? This weekend, half the adults in the UK have now had their first suck the sauce bottle. And we're ticking them off one by one. So your sister, my wife, is joining Team Lizard on Tuesday.
Yes. So that's like, nearly the whole family done? Well, actually the whole family of that generation kind of done.
Yeah. Somehow we're still not quite sure how Noah managed to get someone to jump the queue, my 17-year-old, but he's sorted now. So it's only Tom, my 20-year-old son, and I think...
Chloe, my 21-year-old daughter, hasn't had hers. But,
No, they're more towards the back of the queue, but probably
yes.
Rightfully so.
Yes, so I think she prefers a different kind of shots.
Exactly. Ah, back the day when a man can pour a flaming Sambuca in his eye. That's the how I've missed those. No, I haven't. I've never liked a shot. I've never understood it.
No, I don't get the idea of suddenly becoming out of control. I'd rather gently kind of climb towards ensozzlement.
Exactly that. So how's the rest of your week been?
It's been great. Another good week at work. Great people. Learning more stuff. Getting things done. I don't know. I thought I was going to be anxious, actually, to be fair, after it being 2.5 years since I worked somewhere out other than being able to work from home. But that's not actually the case. It's really easy to get the bus every morning. They do a testing regime at work, so you get you get tested once a week, and you know everything's cleaned within an inch of its life. So it does make a difference actually. I don't know. It's just the simple thing of actually coming home and getting changed out of
an
outfit that I've worked. I was going to say costume, but I didn't. You know, I don't go to work dressed as a Mario brother or something. I'm enjoying it. It's going really well. How about your week? You've been on holiday this week?
Yeah, halfway through a 2-week holiday. We've been decluttering. It's been lovely actually. We just kind of sorted we finished the kitchen. And it was just nice. We live on the same estate and I don't need this stuff anymore. Is it any use to anybody? And so I stuck one of our garden benches out on the drive, stuck the stuff out there. And, you know, again, we were very open about it. Some of it was a little bit banged up, but if it did somebody a turn, happy days, gone. 80% of it gone within half a day.
Brilliant. As long as Nicola didn't think you were one of the things that she's... enough with and stick it on the drive for
but again, we tackled the cupboard of almost certain death, as it's known.
Oh dear, everyone has one.
Yeah, there were items in there that we owned an electric omelette maker.
Why the bloody hell does anybody need an electric omelette maker?
No one seemed sure. It'd never been used, so
I can't think why.
It's gone on now to allow somebody else to make omelette. So yes, decent week, and obviously on this day. 2021,
yes.
We all got to fill in our census.
Yes. Oh, that's very true. Yes. So I did mine the other night because, you know, nothing was going to change in the space of time between then and tonight. So I thought I'd get it out of the way because I thought otherwise it will be a rush on the 21st, and then I'll feel awful for not remembering to do it. But yes. Yeah, so if you haven't done your census already, please, we implore you. It's very, very important. Important things like local services depend on knowing how many people are where and what they're doing. And if you haven't got a tracker jab, sorry, no. Please, if you haven't filled it in already, please. It's honestly, it takes 10 minutes. It's really easy.
If there's four near adults in the house, it takes a little bit longer. But yeah, no, it's not difficult. And again, it was that weird thing where we did ours online. And it was that element of, well, naturally you would. But if you look back at the 2011 census, I don't believe there was an online option.
No, there wasn't. I mean, I don't think, I think internet use was widespread at that point, but probably nothing like we consider it now. But no, I think you're right. This is the first time there has been an online option to complete the census. So that's really, really good. And I know that the ONS has been employing loads of people to make sure that runs smoothly. Yeah, good luck for everybody involved. Please do remember to do it. It's really, really important. And the other thing you've been doing this week is trying to get hold of people to line up for our virtual hustings.
Oh, the virtual hustings. Good Lord. Local politicians. It's like herding cats. although we've got two in the diary now, so our policy has been if we get two of the candidates who put their hands up and say yes, then we will pencil that in. So the 4th of April is Paul's Grove, Port Solent. The 11th of April is Eastnean, Craneswater. And the 18th of April is Police and Crime Commissioner. So if you are politically active, as many of our listeners are, please can you just give your local councillor or your local candidate a nudge if they are in either Paul's Grove, ENC, Milton, Central South Sea, and Charles Dickens. If we do get all five, it's going to give us a few logistical problems, but we'd rather have that than not hear people speak.
It would be a weird hustings if no one turned up.
Yeah, and I think there's the, you know, it's an interesting one because we obviously are very mindful that we are open with our political coloration, but the hustings will be us simply providing a platform and some space for the candidates to A, give their perspective on why they want to serve, and B, answer the questions that for all councillors, there's not going to be looking to catch anybody out, you know, or try and yank anybody's trousers down virtually. It is simply a chance for people to discuss the issues that affect Portsmouth.
Yeah. And if you are a resident and hopefully a registered voter in those wards, I think there's still time for you to register to vote if you're not. Please do submit either on our event page or by messaging us directly or by emailing us at pompeypoliticspodcast@gmail.com. Let us know which ward that question is for and if you do live in the ward, because although questions from people outside the ward won't be excluded, we do think it's probably a better thing to prioritise questions from people living in the ward because these are their candidates. And this is their chance to kind of get them to speak. But we'll be fair. Each candidate will have some time at the beginning to make an opening statement. Each question has to be one that we can ask to all candidates. Yep. And they'll all have the same amount of allotted time to answer each question, and they'll have the same amount of time to make a closing statement. So in that respect, it's really down to them to say yes if they'd like to, which would be really great. And if you're a candidate and you've got some questions or concerns, please give us a bell, because we're honestly not frightening. Anybody that's been on will tell you that we're actually quite soft and cuddly.
Especially me.
Yeah. Sorry, I think the line dropped out then. I think Mark Zuckerberg nearly just cancelled us. Please do. So let's move swiftly on this day.
Yes.
So 1933, the day of Potsdam in Nazi Germany, a ceremony to open the new Reichstag after the fire in February, which was attended by Adolf Hitler and Paul von Hindenburg, the president of Germany, So they shake hands in public. But, weirdly enough, on the same day in 1943, there was an assassination attempt on Adolf Hitler.
They really, you'd hope somebody would have got him sooner than that. But
you'd have thought, but Tom Cruise let us down.
Yeah. He is a letdown, though, isn't he, Tom Cruise? He annoys me.
He can afford better lawyers than I can, so I'm going to be careful.
I've just never forgiven him for the Jack Reacher thing.
But Jack Reacher's meant to be kind of really tall, and Tom Cruise isn't.
So Jack Reacher is my favourite fictional character, and he's 6'5" and 18 stones. So who would cast Tom Cruise at 5'5" and 8 stone as Jack Reacher? Answer, Tom Cruise's production company bought the rights to the Jack Reacher series, and he cast himself.
Well, of course, that's what you can do if you own your own production company. Yeah. But, you know, I don't know that he's 8 stone. I mean, that would be really unhealthy weight for him. But nonetheless, we're not going to obsess over people's weight. We're not that kind of organisation. 1947, US President Harry Truman signs Executive Order 9835, requiring all federal employees to have allegiance to the United States. Hopefully, no administrations over here are taking hints on that. 1963, Alcatraz Prison in San Francisco Bay is closed. Because apparently it's not a good idea to send people to be locked up on an island. People on the Isle of Wight are glad of that conclusion, I guess. We're obviously both off the island, so
Big old prison on the Isle of Wight, though, isn't there?
Yeah, but it's not the whole island, is it?
Some say.
There's our listenership dropping by, like, one person a month that listens from the Isle of Wight. In 2013, the European Space Agency reveals new data that indicates that the universe is 13.82 billion years old.
And that's one of those things which hardcore science nerds get excited about, but a couple of billion either way, I'd forgive them. I don't think it's got a great deal of bearing on my day-to-day existence.
Yeah, but if it was a student loan, it would make a difference, wouldn't it? So, the whole universe was in a hot, dense state, but nearly 14 billion years ago, expansion started. Wait. Anyway, 2019, New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announces a ban on military-style semi-automatic weapons just 6 days after the Christchurch terrorist attack. So apparently
Dark day in New Zealand's history, that one, wasn't it?
It was, but America, apparently it is possible to put controls on semi-automatic weapons if you want to.
Oh, you can, but not in America.
No.
Let's not go there. Oh. You know, there's
what,
four
to America
handgun-
or the subject?
Did you know that there are 4 handguns for every American citizen in the US?
I didn't know the stat, but I guessed that was probably the case. I'd assumed that because of the number of guns that gun fetishists have, there's more likely to be more guns per capita. Yeah. But there we go. That was on this day. I've been Simon Sansbury, so we move on.
I think we should. So the highlights, the edited highlights of the council meeting last week, we picked a few motions and How did it all end up then, Simon? Talk us through it blow by blow.
We picked a few motions and nobody made a joke about the motions, considering they were one of the items being discussed was dumping of sewage. Chuckled about that.
Snigger, poo joke. Well done.
Sorry. We've set the level. Right. It's there. So, okay, yeah. So, so the ones that we'd picked out last week were Motion 15A, which was the calling on our local MPs to support the Climate Emergency and Environment Bill. The other one that we discussed was the question about... thanking... We talked about there was a Conservative motion to thank the government for the rollout of the vaccine. And the other one that we spent some time on was 15G, which was the right to food, which came from the Labour group. So we kind of picked one from each.
Yep.
We thought that was, in BBC style, that was balance.
Yeah, and if everybody accuses us of being biased, then again, in the same way as the BBC, we've got to be doing something right. So should we start with climate?
Yes, let's start with the climate. So, should we play a couple of clips?
Yeah.
So let's treat the audience with someone else's voice than ours. So we have. I'm going to play the climate. I'm just going to make sure I've got actually the right video lined up. So I'm going to play the climate clips. So what we're going to hear is. So we're going to hear Councillor Will Purvis introduce the motion. Then we've got Councillor Atkins speaking to the motion. And I forget who it was after that, but I'll introduce them. There is, if you hear a bong sound, as in that sounds a bit like a sensor beep, that's not us going mad and the councillors concerned swearing and us cutting that out because they were restrained enough not to swear in the meeting. That's just me indicating that I've abridged their comments. So if it's the same person speaking, it doesn't make what I don't want to make it sound like is that I've cut out some of their language without it being clear that I've cut out some of it, because I think it's fair to say up front that bit's been edited. That makes sense.
Yeah, go
press the big red button.
The climate emergency is real. A matter of months ago, really, before COVID overtook all the other considerations, it was the young people of our city who stood on the steps of the Guildhall. They were crying out for us and other politicians to take action on the climate crisis. But since then, this has become a rallying cry across the political and social spectrum. When you see a call for a green revolution on the front page of The Express, and only this week our own local paper, The News, launched their support for the Climate Action Board that we set up to make Portsmouth a greener city, then this is not a niche issue, nor is it owned by any party or campaign group.
We as a Labour group are of course passionate about the need for urgent action to tackle the climate ecological emergency. And we, along with the city's Labour MP Stephen Morgan, support the aims of the bill. And whilst of course we support the intention of the motion, it is somewhat disingenuous and naive to think what is of course merely a presentation bill could be enacted into law by this government. There will be no votes on the matters contained within the bill, and only a very small number of private members' bills ever become law, these being ones that have been supported by the government. What the bill does do, however, is to help draw attention to the issue, which requires real change at law.
Okay, so that was the new leader of
National
the Labour
level.
Group.
And we are the only country in Europe
from Conservatives
that is currently proposing to ban petrol cars by 2030. We have the aim to be carbon neutral by 2050. We are actually one of the most ambitious countries in the world. And I appreciate that for the Green Lobby, you can never go far enough.
It's been said today, there's a lot of pandering. There's an election coming up. You've got people trying to basically own the green agenda. Fine, let whoever's voting for you decide on that. But I think that one of the things which we've actually already spoken on today that we've seen deputations made about was with regards to Southern Water. And I think that actually some of these more local environmental issues are far more important than some of the things that we could shout about that MPs in Westminster are actually charged and elected and paid to deal with. And the discharges into Langstone Harbour, for example, I think are a massive concern. And then when you add into the mix the problems with Atwind as well, and of course, I think we would all prefer that they would have gone up through the harbour with this ongoing saga that they have. It's a bit of a maelstrom of trouble when you look at the whole ecological issue that we're currently faced with. It's almost like a perfect storm. And for me, I think those are the things that we should be concentrating on.
So... yeah, so
a case of violent agreement there, really, wasn't it? You know, there is an element of, and I do think it is fascinating that the green agenda, has I think transcended party politics.
Yeah, I mean it has definitely gone mainstream, quote unquote. So it's definitely not a fringe issue anymore, and indeed to some degree environmentalists might express a frustration that with all parties pretty much actually claiming to have green credentials, It's a bit, I think, greenwash is the phrase that, that some of them might use with regards to that. So I think there's a, I think there's kind of a, there's a point there of actually, to some degree, actually it's quite healthy that environmental groups are holding, holding whatever administration in whatever authority to account, and actually challenging them to do more, and ever more, because it's only by, you know, because let's be honest, we can't rest on our laurels and think, okay, this is kind of enough. But there was kind of like a bit of a political to and fro with regard to, so the motion effectively called on the council to say, hey, our two local MPs, one of which would normally be in the meeting, but I think if I remember correctly, Stephen Morgan wasn't in this part of the meeting. To basically agree to, there's a, you know, basically there's an online agreement to, there's, I think, 101 MPs that have signed up to say that they're going to vote to support the Climate Emergency and Environment Bill. Labour were pointing out that it's an early day motion, so that doesn't mean that the government's actually required to enact it into law. And also the Conservatives pointed out that actually as a member of the government, Penny Mordaunt MP is actually precluded from signing up to early day motions. And then there was a debate, sorry, a bit of an exchange with regards to has there been some sort of whip or steer from the Labour front bench to the same effect? And Labour claiming that that wasn't the case, but that they were also excluded from being able to do that. And there were, you know, conversations about, well, hang on, hasn't Keir Starmer signed up to an early day motion last year, etc. All of that kind of to-ing and fro-ing. But really fundamentally, actually, I think Rob's, Councillor New's point there is, these are things that actually our national government deals with. And what, and it, and this is the question that's posed, what is the effect of the council saying, calling on the MPs, which are, who are answerable to the, to the voters of the city rather than to the council, hey, go vote a particular way in Parliament? I think there's a, there's an interesting thing there.
Yeah, I think so. And again, with all three of the motions, you could, you know, it depends which hat you want to wear, but you could be a little bit cynical about all three of them. But I think there's an element of, of, you know, the setting your stall out clearly is something which is good. And I thought, for me, Councillor New was right to say perhaps there are areas closer to home where, you know, the council and local political parties, and I think, you know, we've had the Stop Aquint team on twice, you know, which is, has become a very cross-party, you know, a cross-party position to do what's right for Portsmouth. So based on all the chat then, Simon, was there, were there any amendments proposed?
So there was an amendment from the Labour group, which the proposer, which was, but because it's, the motion was proposed from the Lib Dems, so the proposer was Will Purvis, and he didn't accept the amendment from the Labour group. But then the council group, the council actually voted to accept the amendment, 21 for, 17 against, with 3 abstentions. So it was the, I think it was the PPP and the independent councillor Ferret that voted, that abstained. But yeah, so that actually amendment was then subsumed into the motion. And then the motion overall with the amendment was then passed by ascension. So conversation, disagreement, point scoring, chuck about, then everybody agrees.
So can you, and again, not trying to put you on the spot, what was the Labour amendment? What amendment did Labour want?
That is trying to put me on the spot, because I...
You can't remember? No, but ultimately, it can't have been that offensive, because everybody then said, oh, let's just go on then.
So... No, I, without calling to the detail, I think it called on there being specific elements that that needed to be addressed. And about basically not enough kind of being done going forward. I think it kind of also teased out a further conversation that Councillor Wemyss contributed to about the concern of, so part of the language for the bill talks about putting in citizens' assemblies. So the, right. the question was about how valid is that of a, as a decision-making body? And yep. does that override the democratically elected decision-making bodies that we have? Does that, in and of itself, even though obviously those are members of the public, is that something that is a concern or not? So I think there's some stuff to tease out there about process, yep. and some stuff to tease out there about, look, it seems that everybody wants to do something. They're not necessarily quite sure on exactly what and how and when, but everybody agrees that something should happen. But from a mechanics,
not sure how.
Not sure.
Isn't that a beautiful allegory of local politics as a whole? Everyone agrees that stuff needs to be done. No one can quite agree how they need to do the stuff.
What do we want doing? We want stuff done. When do we want it? And how do we want it?
It could be a bit pricey. So that one's through. How did motion number two?
So the second one that we discussed was the Conservative motion calling on the council to thank the government for the vaccination rollout.
Yep.
And the Conservatives pulled that motion, so it wasn't discussed.
Oh. That's strange.
I literally can't speak to something that doesn't have any conversation from the council. It's one of those rare occasions where there's... Even I can't talk about things that didn't happen.
No. What a very strange and odd thing to do. Just to be fair, I guess... Yeah, well, nothing to say, really, is it?
No. And as far as I'm aware, there weren't amendments submitted that, you know, because sometimes if a party would put forward a motion, other parties will effectively poison that motion by suggesting amendments that the original party would know would get passed and therefore actually make the motion as a whole distasteful enough to the party that proposed the motion, so therefore, if you see what I mean, so they might call it.
Yeah, no, and there was a lot of that done during some of the Brexit stuff, where you know people would put on amendments that then get voted down, which would be that they've just voted against the not battering kittens with a stick amendment. And it's like, oh God, yeah. So okay, well, I'm going to say thanks to the government anyway, because more than half of the UK. Adult population vaccinated by the third weekend in March is bloody good stuff, and hopefully we're not going to get into a massive scuffle over vaccine availability with our old partner in the EU. Whilst we've divorced, this is not arguing about who gets the CD collection, is it?
No, but yes. Yeah, so I'll thank the government for having the wisdom to let the NHS manage it.
Now. Right.
There we go. Is that like a paraphrasing of a Ricky Gervais joke?
Ricky Gervais isn't a funny man. I don't rate him. Never have.
Yes. Indeed. Scott Peter Harris points out that there's a bit of the conversation that we missed. Yes. Sorry, Scott, but an hour long conversation that we can't abridge in like 5 minutes. We didn't discuss about that because there's other angles to that which possibly are worth discussing in other shows, but we had to kind of trim to some degree.
Which one is this? Is this the first one?
He's talking about the first one.
Cool. No. And the challenge is always when we do these things is we try and bring balance and different representations to this, and you know we are. We didn't discuss when it finally all finished, but we're usually trying to cram 8 hours plus.
Something has to end up on the digital cutting room floor, I'm afraid.
Exactly.
So the other motion that we talked about last week was the right to food, which was brought forward by the Labour group.
Yep.
And I also have some clips there. And let me... So to start off, we've got Councillor Tom Coles basically is part of his opening statement, and then he's followed by Councillor Atkins, Councillor Stubbs, Councillor Norton, and then Councillor Horton, and then Councillor Councillor Coles, then closes off the conversation. So let's listen to that quickly.
Yep. We live in a very wealthy country, yet every day millions of people have to rely on food banks to ensure their children can get a decent meal. Many of these people are in work. However, due to a variety of factors, such as low wages and high rents, are unable to provide. 11 million Britons are living in food poverty. For them, a choice has to be made on a daily basis between eating or having the heating on.
Because we have to think about the multifaceted reasons why people end up going hungry in this country. And it's too simplistic to say that the only reason is the rate of benefits. And the government has committed throughout the pandemic to providing food vouchers. It responded in the end to Marcus Rashford's campaign in exactly the way that everyone wanted, as well as putting a huge sum of money available to the councils across the country to provide for food. It's throughout the crisis paid an uplift of £20 in universal credit. We can say, yes, it's we can call it the government's responsibility to feed children throughout school holidays, but ultimately if they have parents who are addicted to drugs, if they have parents who don't engage with the system, the government, unless social services reach those children, unless they find them, they're not going to get fed. It's not actually the case that the government can solve all of the problems of the world, or necessarily put food on every plate across the country.
It's important for everyone to bear in mind that the cost of food has never been lower in all of human history. That, and I have a report in front of me now from the Institute of Fiscal Studies, which shows that in 1977, a typical household spent 25% of its income on food. By 2010, that had dropped to 15%. Look, if it was me and I was short of food, I'd buy an enormous bag of rice. Now you say, well, that's not a great meal, but it is something, and there is no reason why people cannot afford to eat. And, you know, we get this narrative all of the time from the left. I mean, who'd have you believe that we are living in a Dickensian society where things are falling to pieces, where people can't afford to eat and can't afford to buy clothes, and everything's going to hell in the handbasket. But the fact is that, as I said, food has never been cheaper, and this country as a whole has never been richer. Look, my father in the middle 1950s spent some time in Ireland and traveling around Ireland and rural Ireland, and he said that back then you would see children without shoes. Now you never saw that in London even then, but you did in Ireland, and that is what poverty looks like. Poverty of that era has just completely gone, and I think we should recognize that and celebrate it, quite honestly.
And I'm going to go from a child perspective here, because the campaign is heavily driven around the image of children going hungry. All the money provided to make sure that no child goes hungry, and then the disappointment that we had from charities after the last wave of hysteria, who made meals only for none to be collected. So after a quick bit of research, I got to the bottom of this, and of course it's a union-driven campaign, isn't it, from Unite the Union. If the motion looked at the relationship that we have as a country with food, if it spoke about the fact that, you know, 30% of our adults are obese, and it tackled the high percentage of deaths surrounding obesity, and the issue that we have, the agricultural issues that we have, then, you know, I'd have more time for it. But I think it's lazy. I think all this does is push a virtue signalling agenda and nothing else. And the list goes on and on and on. So the idea that the government aren't putting food on the tables of people is simply not true. And from a child's perspective, you know, if parents still aren't feeding their children despite all of the issues and all of the support and the money that the government is giving, then the sad reality is that they're probably not going to. And that's an issue for social services. So what's required here is a shift in priorities, not a shift in resources.
And I just feel that I need to actually speak up for people who have a lived experience that is not that of the front page of the Daily Mail. I cannot believe some of the assumptions and the stereotypes that are talking there. Anyway, I know it's a union motion, but actually it's about food, and it's about poor children. It's about children who are the victims of a very complex situation, who are hungry. So I welcome the motion. We are a rich country. We do have noticeable increases in people queuing up for food banks, and I doubt they do it just for the lols. I think this motion actually is a big picture one, and I do want to mention a few things about that have happened on a local level, because actually that is where we should be focusing, as you've quite rightly said, about the local children, local families. And I am not surprisingly going to focus on children. Actually, the pandemic for me has just shone a light on inequalities were already there, and it's forced us to deal with them and in a kind of emergency situation. And in a sort of paradoxical sense, it's been one of the silver linings of the pandemic. Very, very, very quickly, it became apparent that families in the city rely on school not just as a place of learning, but a place to be fed. Universal free school meals at Key Stage 1 and means-tested free school meals through child's education are valued more than ever. And I think it's an opportunity for us to have a rethink. From day one of lockdown, the provision of food has been a priority, and it hasn't gone away. One of the earliest decisions that was taken to ensure that the food banks were stocked up, but actually schools worked straight away with the council on identifying children who needed free school meals. Either they were taken to their houses or they came and did a grab and go thing. And that stayed as a key issue throughout the whole pandemic. We made a decision at the earliest point, as you know, to provide the food vouchers for Christmas before Marcus Rashford did shame the government into doing a U-turn. And we immediately pledged that we would do the same at Easter if there was no further U-turn. And we also included early years and colleges at Christmas and now at Easter. And there was a very good reason for that, is because actually families were identifying the fact that that was a lifeline to them. And it's not the stereotype that's being painted. I had so many people contact me. I could give loads of examples, but somebody who owns their own house, whose child is in a private school with a scholarship, feeding 200 hungry kids, said that without the vouchers over the summer holiday, she wouldn't have been able to afford it. She's got no cash to do that, but actually and really valued them. So it's not all the stereotype that's being made.
Others. And I'm shocked that the Conservative groups obviously using this motion to outright wing each other in an attempt to push their own leadership credentials for the group. Using a motion to attack the most vulnerable in society is a disgrace, and I am disgusted. This motion is about people. Thank you, Lord Mayor.
So that was the last motion that was before the council.
Emotions running high, it would seem.
Emotions were definitely running high. I think it was... Because let's also remind ourselves that the context, what the motion actually calls for is for the council to say that the review that's being done into what the UK food strategy is, it's calling for it to consider including a right to food. So it's not,
yes.
You know, it's not, I mean, for what it's asking for, I think it seemed, yes, of course, the prospect of anybody going hungry and certainly children going without food is something that I'd have thought everybody and indeed everybody expressed that concern that wasn't something that they wanted to see.
Yeah.
But it's just a real example of, everybody seemed, or the differing sides, as it were, have different views as to how you should address that and who is responsible for making sure that no child goes unfed.
Yeah, and to be honest, it is one of the issues of the last 6 months particularly, where it is used for political gold. It is the... You know, somebody stands up and says, look at the poor starving children. The children are starving. No one's going to say good, are they? They're going to, you know, and when you start to talk as, you know, that middle piece, when you start to lay out some of the truths and realities, you know, such as food is relatively the cheapest it's ever been in the whole of human history. You've got the ability to, you know, to purchase food cheaper than you ever have. We've got measures around poverty which are about relative poverty. And I think there is an element of, if you look over the last period, you know, over recent history, more money than ever has been pushed towards the poorest in society. And it's right that it should have been. But to that point, will it ever be enough? And is it just too easy? And I think Terry Norton used the word, it's just lazy to stand up and say children are hungry and it's all the government's fault and they need to sort it out by spending more money.
But to be fair, that's not what the... I mean, obviously, being a, you know, the motion is calling on, effectively, it calls on the review to consider including a right to food. It's not necessarily kind of dictating to a government spend of X amount of money or a particular thing. I just find it strange that the examples being used are situations where it's almost like the conversation and the focus of the issue is being railroaded. And the actual issue is, whatever the reason, whether that's because someone doesn't earn enough, sadly, or whether because there's trouble at home, because the parents have mental health issues, or because they're otherwise unwell, or because
they don't know how to cook.
Yeah. Whatever those, and on both sides there were both sides of the argument. There were people saying, look, the reasons for the cause are multifaceted and aren't as simple as you should increase the benefits. And both sides then actually seem to get want to make a point of saying, but I didn't say it was only about benefits. But actually, both sides actually said it's not only about benefits, it's more complex than something so simplistic. So for me, if there are people in this country, and if there are children that are in this country that are not getting the food that they need, I want that to be addressed. And that isn't just about throwing money at stuff, which seems to be the thing that I think kind of raises the hackles of the blue team. If I don't know what the actual causes are, I can't speak to what I think the solutions are. But to say, actually, our societal aim should be that everybody has decent food, that it means that they're actually well nourished and that they're fed. Surely that's not a bad thing in the 21st century for the sixth richest country in the world to have.
And that's where it's an interesting, because you touched on it on our second segment, which is about not necessarily what you're trying to achieve, but the way in which you frame your objective. So I remember reading the motion before it was debated. Mm-hmm. And the point for me in the way that motion was framed was that as a Conservative, I could not vote for that. Because the motion was framed in the, we have so much spare money that everybody should have enough to eat all the time. And the fact that we haven't is entirely down to the Conservative government. So we call upon this council to support a motion that says we should fix that. And it's the framing of that motion. And you heard the very emotional closing remarks of Tom Coles, which for me was the entire politicking around the, well, typical Conservatives, they want to steal the bloody bread off of children's plates. I'm appalled and disgusted. Well, that's not what anybody said. But there is an element of, from a political standpoint, this is a very, very useful tool to try and create a point of differentiation between Conservative fiscal prudence and, if we were in government, we would have fixed that by now, from members of the left.
I think there are, I mean, yes, the Labour group have put forward a motion that's worded in the way that the Labour group have obviously wanted to be written, because they're the ones that have written it.
Yeah.
But in the same way that the wording of the motion, if you're saying that was poisonous to the Conservatives, it's the flip side of, and I'm just scratching from memory of a recent example of a similar sort of reaction, it's a similar kind of situation to everybody else's reaction to the Conservative motion a few months ago that basically called on the council to say that it wouldn't work with groups like Extinction Rebellion. Because of actually the way that it was worded and what it, and, you know, fundamentally.
Because
the wording was attached about thanking our, you know, our veteran service personnel and respect to them, which that bit, everybody, of course everybody was going to bloody agree with, but because it was actually wrapped in this poison wrapping paper, everybody else found that a toxic thing to deal with. And this, so is what you're saying, this is the equivalent of that for, this is the kryptonite for the Conservatives. Because the Conservatives aren't sitting and saying, yes, baby should starve. They're not saying that.
No, they're just saying we're not going to vote for something that says... For me, the Conservatives that spoke very eloquently about some of the different factors that are in play, the complexities, and I think it was Councillor Stubbs who... You know, that there has been a desire, particularly from the hard Labour left over the last 5-10 years, and you see it on social media, to paint a dystopian broken Britain narrative. You know, that has been their narrative for at least the last 5 years, about inequality and poverty and how everybody's having a terrible time of it, and it's all down to the Tories. So there is an element of, you know, this amendment had all of those bits of red glitter across it, and so naturally there was going to be a response. So ultimately, we now need to find out. I think I might be able to guess, but I'm not going to. I take it it wasn't unilaterally assumed by all.
No, it wasn't. It did. The motion did pass with 26 voting for, 12 against, and 3 abstentions. So for me, the interesting call out was, and whether it was intended or not, was that the Lord Mayor actually voted in this motion, whereas normally he abstains. And 3 of the Conservatives, the three councillors that abstained, Frank Jonas and Scott Peter Harris abstained, if memory serves. So I don't know. At the end of the day, I think it's a poor argument to say that people aren't really poor and there isn't really a need, when there obviously is, and people's lived experience says that there isn't. I don't believe for a minute that people don't want to fix that. So let's focus on fixing that instead of arguing over who said what and point scoring on it. I don't know.
There is an element of we all want it not to happen. I think the challenge that we have, and I've discussed this infinitely online, is defining what poverty is and defining what it looks like and defining what is a reasonable level of income that people, quote unquote, should be able to ensure that their children never go hungry.
But to be fair, that's not what the question is. The fundamental question is money. Money in and of itself, and you know, we could. Yeah, sorry, I'm going to have to. Let's.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, no. Look, right to food. Should everybody be able to eat? Yes, of course.
Right.
But you know, ultimately, that isn't a. For that to be a motion in itself, should everybody be able to eat? Yes. Let's move on then. But anyway, we've done it. It passed as we thought it would do, mm-hmm. Or as I thought it would do, along the lines that it should have done. And there endeth the council. But do we have the finish time?
So, yes. It finished, was it 10:30?
Oh, I think that's me.
Was it?
I thought I said 10:43.
I can't remember.
I think we passed a little.
We'll have to have some independent adjudication on that, or at least another vote, because I'm sure you didn't know what you were voting for.
You need to go on a march first. But
if I wanted to go on a march, I might fall foul of the legislation. Let's see what we did there.
Segue, that is.
It's amazing. It's almost like we prepare these things, which we really don't. So the Police and Crime Bill that passed its second reading at Parliament this week.
It did, along somewhat partisan lines, it would have to be said.
Mm-hmm.
I think the margin was 84. which all of the Conservatives voted for it. Everybody else voted against it. But it's an interesting, I guess the first thing to say, and it's been boiled down to as all politics must be these days, it's been boiled down to a few shouty headlines. I don't know whether you read the full bill, Simon.
I didn't read the full bill, but I looked at some of the key things that were kind of teased out from various media outlets or from the actual front page from the government's website. So
yeah, I'd like to say I'd read it. It's a 307-page bill.
Yeah,
a lot of it in legalese. So I thought I'd I went to the give me the edited highlights.
So the fundamental thing of the bill, and it does lots of other different things that may or may not be of interest, but I think the ones that have raised the most interest are, for example, that measures including the. An up to 10 years jail term on people who vandalise statues.
Yep.
To make sure that there's right of vehicular access to Parliament so that any protests that take place can't stop people attending Parliament in order to continue their business.
Yep.
In line with what arrangements need to take place for marches, that static protests require agreement from the police, and that they have the power to basically deal with what is loosely defined as significant annoyance or disruption, and the Home Secretary has the ability to decide and define what that is, or indeed what other measures would be needed in order to do that. So the government, quite understandably, says these things are necessary. If they didn't think they were necessary, I guess they wouldn't be putting the bill forward. Whereas demonstrators, rights protesters and freedom of speech advocates are saying, hang on a minute, this gives the Home Secretary too many sweeping legal powers. It effectively allows the police to consider that you're breaking the law if you're causing disruption or that you're too loud, because they're allowed to set the volume of disruption. Mm. And that a disruption can be one person. It doesn't need to be a number of people. So if you think, if I'm really honest, and it kind of refers to it in the preamble to the bill, this bill is designed to stop activities like the protests carried out by Extinction Rebellion the year before last. God, it feels like, yep. And as an example, the sorts of protests by Steve Bray, who became well known across the country by shouting "Stop Brexit" in earshot of every television station that was parked up on Parliament Square.
Yeah. Now, this is going to be an interesting one, isn't it? Because we are, whilst we have a left and right disparity in our relationship, we also have a slight authoritarian libertarian. Difference of opinion, as Jimmy Tarbuck would have said. So the bill itself, I find it's an interesting one for me, because that "Stop Brexit" shouty chap,
Steve Bray.
Yeah. Honestly, I just no outcome for him would have disappointed. It was just so irritating. And in terms of being loud and annoying, I think somebody thought about him, stared into the middle distance while they were typing the bill. So, there is an element of, look, the bill in of itself, I get what it's trying to achieve. And something needed to happen. Because the way in which the police are able to manage protests has changed. So there is an element of, if you are a protester now, your ability to cause disruption and to see no consequence of that is probably at an all-time high.
I don't see that as a good thing.
what, the ability to cause disruption or?
No, the ability for the state to define what is what type of disruption or what type of protest they're uncomfortable enough with to actually give people up to 10 years sentences. I find it odd that, you know, we're prioritizing the level of sentences for things like damaging statues when, you know, obviously criminal damage is already legislated against and is already a crime. I don't quite understand how that's more important than addressing other parts of legislation where tariffs on convictions and indeed the levels of convictions seriously need addressing. And I'm not going to open that door because that's a whole other show.
Yeah, that is a whole other podcast.
But from a point of view of the thing that kind of occurs to my mind is that would the women's vote with the suffragettes? Would they have actually been able to protest under the basis that they caused disruption to businesses created inconvenience? While that's inconvenient and causes disruption for businesses, because actually, you know, their protest was a just and valid one, and civil disobedience is actually part of a healthy and functioning democracy.
Well, absolutely. But I think if you but this is where I think the world has changed. So I think if you look at the role of the suffragettes and you look at they created civil disobedience, but there was a framework within law that meant that there were consequences to their actions. Right. And that's where I think it has changed. So if you have a situation, if you look at the situation now, there is an element of if you and I, and we got half a dozen of other of us that decided that we wanted to, you know, bring Gun Wharf to a halt, we could effectively lay down in front of the gates at Gun Wharf, and with just half a dozen of us, then we could bring Gun Wharf to a halt. Now, effectively, if we're just laying there on the ground, the police's only opportunity to move us if we refuse is to try and physically carry us away whilst not hurting us or touching us inappropriately. And there will be somebody with a camera videoing the police and every move they make, looking for them to make one false step so that they can claim police brutality or something inappropriate. So that's where the law stands at the moment in terms of the protesters and in terms of what can happen to us for what we've done, is that ultimately, you know, breach of the peace, there is no consequence to our actions. So at the moment, all the cards are held by the protesters.
But your example wouldn't change if the legislation changes, because the mechanism of removing those people is the same.
Yes, but the tariff that we can, the sentence that we can receive for our actions is no longer just breach of the peace, which is to be bound over not to do it again. There is a deterrent to creating those situations. If we go back and you know, it's not right, but ultimately if you go back 30 years, if we would have laid down in the road causing a protest, the police would have grasped us in a very firm and non-generous way and dragged us away forcibly.
So I always find it weird that your attempt at an example is it was worse in the past, so this isn't as bad as that.
No, and this is trying to, you know, for me, I always look at these things as scales. Well, you've got the rule of law, and you've got the ability of people to protest.
Yeah, and in a functioning democracy, people have the right to protest. People,
yes.
It's to be fair. It's an unrealistic expectation that you can go through life without inconvenience. So to use an example that's quoted in the documentation from the government about the bill, to use an example, the protests by Extinction Rebellion in London, the year before, do I think that they helped their cause by stopping trains moving and stopping people going to work? No. Do I think that's actually helped them get their message across? No. Do I think it was a disruption? Yes. Do I think it should be illegal? No. Because when you start making inconvenience illegal, any form of protest becomes something that you can then say is an inconvenience or a disruption. And yes, yep, that's the point of a protest. You can't just, you know, at the end of the day, you need to get, you know, part of protest is being visible and being noticed. And sometimes that does require causing, albeit usually, mild inconvenience. And in a grand scheme of things, you know, a million odd people marching with blue flags through London and then having a rather nice shindig in Parliament Square isn't a massive level of disruption. Do the taxi drivers in central London agree that it's not a massive level of disruption? Probably not. They probably consider it a complete pain in the backside. But nonetheless, I just am really, really worried that the powers that this bill aims to give the Home Secretary and the powers that it gives the police to be able to define the level of disruption and to be able to actually effectively say this level or this type of protest isn't permitted. I think police officers deserve to be protected from malicious accusations that they've done something wrong, and indeed especially protected from obviously people that seek to harm police officers. But protesters and the public also deserve to be protected from erroneous accusations from the police and indeed assault from the police. So I don't...
That's where it becomes such a difficult area, Simon, isn't it? Because, again, if you've ever tried to move an inert 15-stone man, it is not an easy job to do, even with two people doing the lifting and carrying.
No, it's not. It is a successful form of protest because lifting a dead weight is really difficult. But I don't understand how this change in legislation makes that any easier. They're not getting lighter because of this law.
No, it doesn't. But what it means is, rather than them just being able to be set aside to be bound over to keep the peace, there is a significant custodial deterrent to doing that. If that's the way it goes. And it's interesting you referenced the Extinction Rebellion protests, because if you remember some of those scenes from back in 2019, you actually had, you know, workers and commuters who were trying to get to work to do their job physically attacking the demonstrators who were attempting to
yes,
cause the disruption on the trains.
Indeed, and of course I'm not condoning that those acts of aggression, but I've already kind of said, look, I think it was the wrong mechanism to choose. It was the wrong type of protest. The fact that people protest in different in ways that I wouldn't choose to do is part of us living in a free society. That's just life.
Absolutely. And again, you touched on the suffragettes. You know, the suffragettes were not adverse to firebombing things and breaking windows and probably going much further than most mainstream protesters would today. So the bill has passed its second reading. It'll now head off to the House of Lords. I think the House of Lords being, whilst I'm not a great fan, if I look at it in terms of something like this to provide a bit of cool head and scrutiny, then I'm sure they're going to have a jolly good go at it before it comes back for its next reading.
I'm sure what comes back will be completely different, and objecting to protest is all well and good until you need to protest about something. And what's the saying about, you know, they came for the communists, I wasn't a communist, so I didn't speak up, they, you know, etc. When they came for me, there was no one left to speak up. I just find it an alarming and disturbing thing. I do believe that the police should get the support that they need in order to keep us all safe, but I don't think this is what we should be doing, and it isn't what we should be having in a free democracy. After all, we're criticizing China for removing the right to protest in Hong Kong, and we're kind of doing the same thing.
Well, it's a perspective. I think we're possibly we're balancing the scales to the rule of law, but we were never going to agree on this one, were we? Let's face it. Even though I tried balancing my zen by listening to a bit of Frank Turner while I was doing the research on this, poor old Frank's words of libertarianism obviously haven't been enough for me. But you've been listening to the Pompey Politics Podcast.
Blue and yellow till we die.
I'm Ian Tiny Morris.
And I've been Simon Sansbury.
Lord Mayor. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Well done, Lord Mayor.
Big up, Lord Excellent. Mayor. Bye.
Good night, Lord Mayor.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Pompey Politics Podcast. If you want to make sure you get notifications about upcoming shows and get to know when we're live, we normally broadcast live 6:27 p.m. on a Sunday evening, then follow us on Facebook at Pompey Politics Podcast. You can also follow us on Twitter at Pompey Politics 1. Please, if you'd like to, feel free to leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts, and you can even ask Alexa to play the podcast for you. Alexa, play the latest episode of the Pompey Politics Podcast.
Getting Pompey Politics Podcast, Blue and Yellow Till We Die from Amazon Music.
Alexa,
playing the latest episode.
Stop. See? It's easy.